Dewey went back to bed. "No, honey," he said. "Nothing important. Just another drunk."
What did he want?
Wanted to confess, provided we sent the reward first. A Kansas paper, the Hutchinson News, had offered $1,000 for information leading to the solution of the crime.
"Alvin, are you lighting another cigarette? Honestly, Alvin, can't you at least try to sleep?"
He was too tense to sleep, even if the telephone could be silenced. Too fretful and frustrated. None of his leads had led anywhere, except perhaps down a blind alley toward the blankest of walls. Bobby Rupp? The polygraph machine had eliminated Bobby. And Mr. Smith, the farmer who tied rope knots identical with those used by the murderer. He too was a discarded suspect, having established that on the night of the crime he'd been off in Oklahoma. Which left the Johns, father and son, but they had also submitted provable alibis. So, to quote Harold Nye, "It all adds up to a nice round number. Zero." Even the hunt for the grave of Nancy's cat had come to nothing. Nevertheless, there had been one or two meaningful developments. First, while sorting Nancy's clothes, Mrs. Elaine Seltzer, her aunt, had found tucked in the toe of a shoe a gold wristwatch. Second, accompanied by a KBI agent, Mrs. Helm had explored every room at River Valley Farm, toured the house in the expectation that she might notice something awry or absent, and she had. It happened in Kenyon's room. Mrs. Helm looked and looked, paced round and round the room with pursed lips, touching this and that. Kenyon's old baseball mitt, Kenyon's mud-spattered work boots, his pathetic abandoned spectacles. All the while she kept whispering, "Something here is wrong. I feel it. I know it, but I don't know what it is." And then she did know.
"It's the radio. Where is Kenyon's little radio?"
Taken together, these discoveries forced Dewey to consider again the possibility of plain robbery as a motive. Surely that watch had not tumbled into Nancy's shoe by accident. She must, lying there in the dark, have heard sounds. Footfalls, perhaps voices, that led her to suppose thieves were in the house, and so believing must have hurriedly hidden the watch. A gift from her father that she treasured. As for the radio, a gray portable made by Zenith. No doubt about it, the radio was gone. All the same, Dewey could not accept the theory that the family had been slaughtered for paltry profit. A few dollars and a radio. To accept it would obliterate his image of the killer. Or rather, killers. He and his associates had definitely decided to pluralize the term. The expert execution of the crimes was proof enough that at least one of the pair commanded an immoderate amount of cool-headed slyness and was, must be, a person too clever to have done such a deed without calculated motive. Then, too, Dewey had become aware of several particulars that reinforced his conviction that at least one of the murderers was emotionally involved with the victims, and felt for them, even as he destroyed them, a certain twisted tenderness. How else explain the mattress box? The business of the mattress box was one of the things that most tantalized Dewey. Why had the murderers taken the trouble to move the box from the far end of the basement room and lay it on the floor in front of the furnace, unless the intention had been to make Mr. Clutter more comfortable? To provide him, while he contemplated the approaching knife, with a couch less rigid than cold cement. And in studying the death scene photographs, Dewey had distinguished other details that seemed to support his notion of a murderer now and again moved by considerate impulses. Or, he could never quite find the word he wanted, something fussy and soft. Those bed covers.